And when the red light comes on, we expect you to conclude your argument at that point. These arguments are being recorded, and they're available to the public. So if you get away from the microphones, we don't hear you. So stay right behind the podium if you can. And finally, I'd mention to you, rebuttal is for rebuttal only, and we ask that you not bring up any subject in rebuttal that's not previously been addressed by you or your opponent. And with that, we call the first case of the day, and that's United States of America versus David Rainey. And Mr. Smith, for the United States, we'll hear from you.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Christopher Smith for the United States. Your Honors, the District Court erred in dismissing count one of the indictment and finding that a congressional subcommittee is not a committee for purposes of 18 U.S.C. 1505. I plan to address this issue first and then return to the knowledge issue as well as the procedural issues that have been carried with this case.
Well, I mean, to some extent, doesn't it doesn't it put us in the position of determining whether to apply the technical use of committee versus the common definitional meaning of it?
Your Honor, I'd respond in two ways to that. I would say, yes, that is an issue. On one hand, the Supreme Court has been clear in cases like Pioneer Investment Services that the presumption when Congress uses a word in a statute is that it carries its plain and ordinary meaning, as we believe it did here, and I can go into that. But as we argued in our briefs as well, the way this term is technically used in Congress is not apart from the ordinary meaning of it. Indeed, there are many different types.
There is a difference between a committee and a subcommittee. There's no question about that in Congress.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that a subcommittee is a different type of committee, and I would certainly have no quarrel with the point that it's a different type of committee. But as is evident from the root of the word subcommittee, it is itself a type of committee. And I think
Congress has fragmented itself. Most things are called committees, standing, special, ad hoc, committee of the whole.
Your Honor, that is precisely.
So the operative language comprehends virtually everything. So even if it's a prefix, it is different when it's a subcommittee.
Well, as Your Honor rightly points out, the House rules contemplate a variety of different kinds of committees, of which a subcommittee is one. Our position is that it would need to fall within the generic definition, the plain and ordinary meaning of the word committee, which is a body of persons appointed or elected to consider, investigate, or take action upon.
When you say appointed, would that include non-member appointments to a subcommittee?
By that you mean
the lead counsel that the Senate or the House reaches out to help them do their inquisitorial function.
Well, Your Honor, I think if committee staff is acting
not on staff, not employees, if they use outsiders in subcommittees.
If they used outsiders in subcommittees that are not affiliated with the committee itself, I think that would certainly be a more difficult case.
So what's the limiting principle? Because you have task forces, or what I thought of particularly CRS, GAO. We have congressional entities that aid their power of inquiry.
Well, certainly, Your Honor, we're on our strongest ground when it is a type of committee that is formed under the House rules in the House with members of Congress as
its
members.
But they have lots of other creatures, so I'm asking you, what's the limiting principle?
They do, Your Honors. I believe that this statute, as all obstruction statutes are, should be construed broadly, and that the limiting principle is inherent in the definition of the word committee. If it's a body appointed to report and consider official business of the House, as a subcommittee of the House of Representatives plainly is. The body is appointed to mark up legislation, to conduct inquiries on behalf of the House. This is not a tangential entity, and I think that the cases that Your Honor mentions of, say, a congressional commission or the GAO or whatnot would perhaps be a much closer call than this is here. Here, we're at the very heartland of the statute. And I think it's important that Mr. Rainey has brought up the House rules. And while we don't rest our definition on the House rules, I think that they are instructive in that the term committee is used throughout the House rules. And in places, it encompasses subcommittees.
So if it goes to the jury, is there a pattern? Do you give the House rules to the jury? to make this factual distinction?
Well, Your Honor, I believe it's whether or not this is a committee, I believe, is a question of law.
So the judge would instruct the jury that you are to find that the entity that was spoken to is a committee? That's what you're saying the rule is?
Your Honor, in for example, I know Sands model jury instructions that have, you know, is contemplated to do with an agency in that regard. The suggested model jury instruction is an instruction that said entity is is an agency or a department or whatnot. So I believe that that's the case, and that this court should find as a matter of law that here the congressional subcommittee is a committee for purposes of 1505. But Your Honors, you would not certainly be the first court to do so on that regard. And I turn to the D.C. Circuit's case in Barenblatt, the Supreme Court in Gojack, the Second Circuit in Seeger. Those cases interpreted a different but analogous statute, 2 U.S.C. 192. And at issue in Barenblatt before the D.C. Circuit was the precise meaning of the term any committee of either house, which is the language that's in our statute. And the D.C. Circuit there expressly held that that encompassed subcommittees. And it's important to back up to the rationale of this as well, Your Honors, and that the Supreme Court has made clear that in instances when we're looking at the plain language of the statute and interpreting what a word means in the statute, it's appropriate to do that with the purpose that Congress had in mind when it passed this law. Now, the other argument on this side of the case is that Congress somehow intended the statute to apply only to full committees of Congress, but not to the mechanism through which the House and those full committees does an overwhelming share of its work.
When was the statute enacted?
The statute was enacted originally in 1940, Your Honor, the precursor statute, which was Section 241 of the Criminal Code.
You didn't have nearly as many subcommittees in as you have now.
Well, Your Honor, I think it's certainly true that the importance of subcommittees has increased over time. However, we do know for a fact that there were subcommittees then and that they were investigating matters and conducting investigations which the statute would be relevant to. And I point out in our briefs, we cite this case, United States v. Norris, from the Supreme Court. I believe it was 1936 it was decided. And in that case, just the facts that the case talk about are indicative of the procedures at that time, that the Senate had appointed a committee, which in turn was authorized to appoint a subcommittee, which it did, that investigated campaign finance expenditures. And indeed, a perjury case was brought out of the subcommittee's investigation at that point. And that was before the enactment of the statute. So,
since the enactment, how often do you bring 1505 prosecutions based on alleged obstruction of subcommittees?
Your Honor, I'm aware of three reported cases. I'm sure that that's not the totality of the number. I don't have a statistic for you.
Because they're the workhorses for both branches, so you would think most obstructions would be happening at that level.
Well, and certainly some prominent obstructions have. For example, the Oliver North case, which we cited, came partially out of the obstruction of a subcommittee. And I think it's important on this matter to consider the brief that was filed by the House of Representatives. And they make clear that the purpose of this statute, the only way that the purpose of the statute can be effectuated is for it to encompass the plain and ordinary meaning of the term.
But what about impeachment task forces? They've just chosen different nomenclature. You would say yes or no?
If it is an impeachment task force appointed as a body of the House or the Senate, of either House, to carry out the official business of that body, yes. I think
because
that
you always have 1001, as you did here, to fall back on. So
Your Honor, that's true. It becomes a slightly closer case when we move away from something that Congress is expressly calling a committee. But I think that would be encompassed under the meaning of the term. And it's important that Congress here said any committee of either house. It's not just the word committee, it's any committee, which indicates, as Your Honor rightly pointed out, that there are standing committees, subcommittees, select committees, permanent select committees, committees of the whole, many different kinds of committees in both the House and the Senate. And simply, Congress chose not to enumerate all those different types of committees, but to instead employ a term that encompassed them all by saying any committee. And I'd analogize this somewhat to the firearms cases, which use the word use of a firearm. And that encompasses a lot of different things, discharge, bartering, Congress there
I didn't see that in the briefs. That's going to be very complicated because the Supreme Court has told us look at each of those words separately. Use does not mean barter. I'm not sure where that
Well, that, out of Bailey, Your Honor, and down that line, I'm merely using that as an example to say that there are instances where Congress uses a broad term that encompasses multiple different categories of things.
I mean, this is a criminal statute.
You're right, Your Honor.
And the way you have argued it now, I mean, you're just going to amend it and reach out and get everybody under a criminal statute, which, you know, we just can't do that.
Well, I disagree, Your Honor, that this would either amend or reach out to.
Well, I mean, I understand.
That we believe that we're in the heartland of what the plain text of the statute says. And as Your Honor made clear in your opinion.
It has to have some limitation.
Oh, it certainly does, Your Honor. It has.
What you have, in response to Judge Higginson's questions, you indicated that, I mean, it had no limitations. Anything that.
Not at all,
put together in Congress, I mean, comes within the statute.
Well, you have the other elements of the statute as well, Your Honor, that you have to have corrupt intent and you have to obstruct. Endeavor to obstruct, impede, or influence. But additionally, the definition of what a committee is certainly not open-ended. It has to be a body formed by Congress to carry out the official business of Congress. That doesn't, while that may encompass more than a standing committee of the House or the Senate, as
there you go again. I mean, what you're saying is that the word committee embodies anything that Congress puts together to do its business. I mean, and it just seems like to me you're expanding that term.
Well, Your Honor, the Supreme Court has held that the presumption is that the statute carries its plain and ordinary meaning, and it's never been disputed in this case, either by the district court or by Mr. Rainey, who refers to it as the generic definition in his briefs, the plain and ordinary meaning of the term committee encompasses a subcommittee. And again, I would point out that.
Well, that may be so, but I mean, I would stick with that. I wouldn't go out and say that it has to have committee means committee of some sort.
Well, it certainly means a committee of some sort, Your Honor. And the definition that it's a body of members appointed to consider the official business of the House of Representatives. And again, I'd fall back on the fact Congress has multiple different types of these bodies, simply chosen.
You're relying on the text, any committee.
I'm relying
on
you
say the doctrine, borrow from 192, and then you say the purpose behind the statute isn't an artificial one, just an entity with the name committee. That's basically the orbit of your argument.
That's absolutely right, Your Honor, and we also have a legislative history argument as well. I think that there are multiple.
Because I see your clock's running down. This is oddly presented to us.
Certainly.
and what you've got is an original indictment, then you've got a dismissal. Then you got a motion to reconsider. Correct me if I'm wrong. Then you've got a notice of appeal, but then you're asking us to stay the appeal because you don't believe the second superseding indictment below is divested along with the first.
Your Honor, I would clarify that we did file the motion to hold the appeal in abeyance. That was because at the time we filed that motion, we thought that it was the most efficient way forward. The government's interest in this case is to achieve legal finality on these issues that we may go forward to trial. And before briefing in this case, that was certainly, we felt to be the most efficient way forward before employing the resources of this court on this issue to get a determination from the district court whether we might or might not proceed on what we believe cured an erroneous interpretation of the law.
Is it your opinion that the district court could proceed with the superseding indictment right now pending this appeal?
Your Honor, our position is that the district court maintains jurisdiction over the superseding indictment because it is.
But could it proceed towards trial?
It certainly could not proceed to actually hold the trial on this issue, Your Honor, but it could proceed to resolve motions to dismiss on the superseding.
Could it move to consolidate the original with the superseding?
I don't think it could do that, Your Honor, because it's been divested of jurisdiction.
You don't know of a case, and maybe your opponent doesn't either, where this type of posture is presented to Court of Appeals where the government simultaneously superseded and contends that the superseding indictment is a separate case?
Your Honor, I'm not aware of the precise legal posture, but I point to this Court's cases in Lee and Strickland where
Strickland just says they're two separate indictments.
There are two separate indictments.
I don't think those involve independent appeals where the government simultaneously tells us and hold in abeyance while we sort of go forward on the superseding one, but we couldn't go to trial.
Well, Your Honor, I can represent to the court that if this court reverses, we will proceed on the original indictment in this case.
So you would dismiss the superseding indictment and proceed solely on the original?
Subject to reserving the right to supersede the original indictment, depending on this court's opinion and the future rulings of the district court, we would proceed on the original indictment. Okay. Your Honor, I just would note that this procedural posture is not necessarily where we tried to be or where we wanted to be. We were simply trying to cure in the most efficient way possible what we viewed to be an erroneous application of the law. That did not work out as planned, and we felt when it became clear that the district court was going to dismiss that on the same basis as the original indictment, that there was some risk under law of the case that we would not be able to challenge that issue later on if we did not challenge it at this juncture. So that's why we're here at this point, Your Honor. Okay. And we would ask you to reverse the district court. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Smith, Mr. Weingarten, we'll hear from you.
Good morning. May it please the court, Reed Weingarten for David Rainey. I'll start right in with the plain meaning issue. Of course, that's the primary challenge. We say if you read the statute, you don't see subcommittee anywhere, end of story. Of course, the government says, subcommittee is part of a committee, so you look in a dictionary, everything is fine. Simply stated, we're talking about technical terms here. We're talking about words of art. Committee of either house is not a dictionary term. It is a term of art. It is a term that has application on the Hill. They talk about, or any joint committee. That's not a dictionary term. That is a technical term of art, and you have to look at the context. And if you look at the context, it's all downhill for the government. Congress knows the difference between committees and subcommittees. The members fight like
they make a difference. Why would they make the statute different from someone who lied to a committee and someone who lied to a subcommittee?
Well,
I mean, the same principle is involved.
Well, we get to the primary argument of the government. How in the world can we have a world where you can obstruct a subcommittee? And the answer is fourfold, I would respectfully suggest. We have the rules of strict construction, which are as old as the hills, subcommittees not in. We have legislative history here. There's not one word in the legislative history anywhere that Congress was concerned about protecting subcommittees.
But I don't think you've got a single case saying that subcommittee was meant to be excluded. It's right?
Absolutely true. But
and the statute's been there for
since 1940. Absolutely true. But there are any number of instances where the Congress has considered the difference between committees and subcommittees. There are extraordinarily complex rules as to what a committee can do and what a subcommittee do, and they vary from committee to committee. This is not a 5,000-page statute that's written by lobbyists. This is whether or not congressmen know what to do about an obstruction. They would be vitally concerned and knowledgeable about
this. Yet they are coming in opposing you in their amicus filing and not saying this is a term with technical distinctiveness.
Well, and we read that brief very carefully. Yes, and what they're talking about, today subcommittees are very, very active. Yes, of course, it's true, and Judge Jolly's correct. We have to look back and to see what Congress intended in 1940. I think perhaps the most salient point, they pass statutes all the time distinguishing between committees and subcommittees. They know how to write that word subcommittee.
Then you run into the 192, same operative language, and courts, including the Supreme Court, implied it's not a distinction with a difference.
Well, what I would say about 192, I mean, there's some irony, because if we ever get to trial, these 192 cases are going to absolutely kill the government on Rule 29, because they talk about the authorization, and the trial court came this close to tossing count one on the authorization piece as well. But I would say 192, it's a different statute, it's a different circuit, and the case that they are so crazy about is over 50 years old. And I think the judge below was correct. They just assumed the purpose without looking at the language. And we go back to all the statutes where Congress has distinguished between committees and subcommittees. We're talking about immunity. We're talking about subpoenas. And perhaps most directly, 1001, as you pointed out before. Look, we're not leaving subcommittees completely unprotected. If there's bad conduct with a subcommittee, there could be a perjury prosecution. No one disputes, and there have been many, and I was prosecutor in some of them, perjury prosecutions involving subcommittees. Number two, we have 1001. If you submit a false document to a subcommittee explicitly in 1001, you can be prosecuted.
Again, you would know as well as anybody. I mean, Congress creates these task forces, or the Judiciary Committee creates these subcommittees to look into the most intensely inquisitorial aspects of what they do. That's where witnesses are testifying. That is the workhorse.
Well, I mean, certainly today you could make that argument. Yeah. I don't think you could make that argument back in 1940. But again, they're not without remedies. Prosecutors can use 1001, and they can use.
Why did the government choose this statute as opposed to the other ones that you have enumerated?
I can only guess. I think they probably thought they couldn't make the proof in 1001, and
they charged 1001 in this case.
Well, in a conversation with an FBI agent, not in connection with the matters on the Hill.
I see.
I mean, is there an advantage to the government to have charged under this statute as opposed to another statute?
Well, when I was a prosecutor, I loved obstruction statutes. They're nice and loose. Just about any kind of bad conduct fits in. And there is a lot of language in cases about how broad 1503 is. But, I mean, thinking about strict construction, I think back to the Reeves case where you wrote the opinion in 1985. It was a case that struck terror in the hearts of all feds. The IRS was investigating somebody, and the guy put up a bad lien on the person's house and prosecuted under 1512. There's broad language that obstruction is to be interpreted extremely broadly, but the opinion of the Fifth Circuit, drafted by Judge Jolly, was strict construction. You can't read out an important term, in this instance corruptly, to make your case even if the conduct's bad.
It struck terror in the federal government, right?
Yes.
Everybody
was waiting for liens.
I had that kind of power.
Everybody was looking for liens from the targets of the investigations.
Maybe I'll do it again.
Conference committees, that's embraced by the any committee phrase? A conference committee.
I think it's limited to the words of the statute.
Joint committee.
Yes.
What about, ad hoc committee? Special committee?
I think if it's a committee of the House or the Senate, and, I frankly haven't thought through this exactly, it would be encompassed, but certainly not a subcommittee. I mean, the House is empowered and the Senate is empowered to put together committees.
The more natural distinction, go ahead.
I was just going to say, Mr. Weingarten, it seems to me any committee of either House, and the word committee is not capitalized, it's generic. And,
sure.
I mean, it seems to me that that you have the burden of convincing us that the plain meaning of that term should not be used, but it's a technical meaning. That's not a technical meaning. Any committee of either House, that is simply not a technical or a term of art.
Well,
maybe something. Now, if you would have put subcommittee and conference committees and so on and so on, then perhaps that argument might hold some sway. But it seems to me that your first hurdle is to convince us that this we shouldn't use just the plain understanding of any committee of either House.
Well, I mean, I think of either House makes it a technical term, but I think if that's not if that doesn't get me where I need to go, I certainly think, or any joint committee, to accept the government's reading of the statute, you have to read those words out. I don't think you can do that. Why,
all we have before us, all this other stuff about limitations, all we have here is a subcommittee of a committee. All we have to determine is whether this subcommittee comes under any committee of either House. Now, that's the question before us. Tell me why you think that this, any committee of either House, requires is a term of art that excludes a subcommittee of a committee.
Well, I mean, it's more of what I said before. There is a difference between subcommittees and committees. Congress knows this. When they passed 1001, they were thinking about subcommittees. They included it. They have amended This statute, many times since 1940, in those amendments, they have put in various parts of the statute subcommittee. They haven't here. And so you might say, is there a reason in the world why there wouldn't be subcommittees included in 1505? And I would say the following. I would say there are ways to protect subcommittees by the Department of Justice if crimes have been committed. And again, subcommittees are different than committees. They're much less formal. There's much less supervision.
Do you have any case that where this particular statute has been used to dismiss an opinion, to dismiss an indictment based on the fact that it was a subcommittee investigation?
No, and I want to address a question that Judge Higginson asked. We looked too, and I think there are three reported decisions where prosecutors used 1505 in cases, indictments were returned. We obviously looked. This issue was not addressed. This issue was not raised. And I'm suggesting my brothers and sisters of the defense bar perhaps didn't think about it. Even Oliver North, I was an Iran-Contra prosecutor. I don't remember this issue coming up. So I think this is, you're addressing it for the first time.
And one thing that occurs to me, though, is, you know, a criminal statute is not as flexible, say, as the Constitution is, to adjust to change in circumstances. In other words, the criminal statute is written at a particular time.
Right.
And then to expand it and expand it and expand it, you're rewriting a criminal statute.
Right.
As opposed to, say, in the Constitution, it expands all the time, according to what some people say.
And I'm suggesting we shouldn't expand it here. When the statute was drafted, subcommittees were not included.
I was just wondering, is there any principle involved in that offhand remark about
no.
Judge Brothers said no, and maybe not. But it just seems to me that the criminal statute means what it says at the time that it's written, and if you extend it to cover other circumstances and expand the definitions of it beyond what it meant at the time that it was enacted, is expanding the criminal statute without authority.
Well, of course, I would agree with you, and there is.
I'm not surprised.
There is a remedy here. Let's just say that Congress is upset about this interpretation. They have a vehicle. It's not for you to clean up their work. They can amend the statute. There's an Office of Legislative Affairs in the Department of Justice who does that. This may even be a place where Boehner and Pelosi would agree. This would seemingly not be terribly controversial. And the House amicus people who came and argued here, maybe they can go back to their colleagues and say, let's just put in subcommittee in 1505. Problem solved. It's not for you to do.
Problem would probably not be solved because there's other committees besides subcommittees that's the reason why they have any committee. It's a global term.
Well, it is, except when I think it's narrowed by a statute. But I think the real issue, and this is one of the things we've noodled about endlessly, is there a logic to this? Is there a logic? In 1940, let's say they actually thought about this. Is it conceivable that they would have separated out subcommittees from committees? And does that application have any relevance today? And I think it does. There is a difference between a committee hearing and a subcommittee hearing.
There's one way to look at this, though, looking for a coherent principle that would have been in existence then and now, would be to look at the adjacent text, which says this is limited, this being 1505's criminal orbit, is limited to entities that have been formally delegated the power of inquiry. So the phrase due and proper exercise of the power of inquiry. To me, that would say, okay, maybe not the GAO. That would be that. The government hasn't urged this, but I would think any committee could be comprehensive of anybody that comprises members of Congress, and yet it won't extend to the informal encounter between some outsider and a representative, because that wouldn't have been conducted according to the due and proper exercise of the power of inquiry.
Well, and of course, I mean, we're going to certainly have a frontal assault on
you
that
will,
part when we get
but the Fourth Circuit in the Mitchell case, which I'm sure you know,
we do.
Would suggest that works with any committee to mean a broad set of entities, although only ones empowered to inquire.
Yes, and I think that awaits.
You think you may win on that down the line, but yes. That wouldn't help you win now.
No, but I sort of go back to, I think if you view it as a close call, if you view the language thing as a close call, and then you take into account the context of the statute and the reality of the world on the Hill, and the fact that the Congress knows the difference between committees and subcommittees. They pass statutes where they distinguish between the two. It is the lifeblood.
But they're constantly reorganizing, right?
And they are.
So they maybe don't know as well. They're responding to sort of exigency out there. Even committees are created specially and ad hoc just for one session. So it's a highly fluid organizational structure.
Of course, but that can't be the stuff of a criminal prosecution.
Why not? If the world is, then we're getting into vagueness and notice, and if the world is told, if it's any congressional entity, group of congressmen, who are exercising their power of inquiry duly and properly, you better not obstruct it. That's sort of what the government's asking the rule.
I understand, yeah. But the only problem with that, it runs into the language of 1505.
Unless
does it include caucuses? I mean, this caucus, every state or, every minority group of economic or other or social group has got some kind of caucus in Congress that meet regularly and hear speakers. And
well, I understand that. I mean, I think the safest course here is just to rely strictly on the language of the statute.
Related to that, you would know. I mean, do subcommittees ever have as voting members non-elected officials? When you've served as the lead counsel to a subcommittee?
No. I think my understanding.
Whereas task forces and other entities actually will bring in outsiders, the task force looking into concussions in football.
Yes, yes. I'm not sure what the answer is. I don't have an encyclopedic knowledge of the subject.
They do bring counsel from outside, special counsel. So they do that to help the committees.
Because I don't think the government could bring a 1505 if someone makes a false obstructive. Who knows? Anyway.
I think
can I ask just quickly to clean out a little brush? Are you pursuing the Healy argument that the motions to reconsider actually is that something you're continuing to assert?
It's odd in the extreme to ask a court to ignore Supreme Court authority that seems to be sort of dead on. But I can't read Bowles without saying Healy's dead. Bowles means what it says,
Healy, right?
I'm sorry.
It doesn't cite Healy.
Of course not.
And then would the logic of that mean that there isn't even a creature called a motion to reconsider?
I like motions to reconsider. I like to file them, but
you don't think
how can you read Bowles?
Okay, that's a rhetorical question.
I know, I'm sorry.
But that's all right. What about just Strickland and our authority on superseding? Do you admit that it does seem to be that the law is not what I thought it was, that two indictments, original and superseding, can coexist?
In theory, but when the government goes to the trial judge and says we're pulling off count one, we're pulling off all the flaws that you pointed out, and we're superseding, I think they're dead. I think that makes it moot. I mean, I'm actually more moved by the superseding argument than Bowles.
But strictly.
No, I think two indictments can live together alive at the same time under certain circumstances, and I think it's a very practical question for the court. But I think the exception is when the government takes off the table the original question relating to count one.
Okay, so the simple answer is we need to wrestle with both of them.
I think so.
You are not backing off either.
I'm not, and okay. I don't know how to read Bowles. I mean, it's strong language. They basically say judge-made exceptions to a statutory jurisdictional requirement are illegitimate. I don't know what to do with that other than to say Healy's gone and the 30-day rule has to be applied strictly. Look, they had
we would be creating a split with at least one, maybe two.
No, I understand that completely. Look, to me, it's a sort of a practical issue. They're arguing the same facts, two different theories in two different courts at the same time. That strikes me as gamesmanship. They had an option here. But they could have appealed the trial judge's decision immediately, timely. They could have gotten an opinion from you. If they win, we go back and we try the original indictment. If they lose, they can supersede. That's not what they did. They wanted both at the same time, and it doesn't feel right. It feels like gamesmanship.
But you can dismiss one or the other. You can force them to choose which way they're going to go.
Yeah, but so let's say they supersede three more times, and they're going to sort of play with different theories. On the eve of trial, they'll pick
That's
the one
right.
they like.
You're good. You know how to dismiss indictments. You've already shown that. So this would happen just again. You'd make them, and the court would make them. The district court would make them proceed when whatever they wanted to proceed in, whatever theory they wanted to proceed, and then they're cooked. The other one goes. I mean, that's the way to handle this.
Well, I think it's a more orderly way, if they didn't like the opinion down below, to appeal it timely and get an opinion from you, and then we go to trial with whatever's left.
That's why we're here, because somebody messes up.
Yes. The last point, I guess I have a minute. The last point I'd like to make is to sort of reinforce this idea that there really is a difference between subcommittees and committees. It's not irrational for you to follow the strict language, and it's about informality. This case is about an informal briefing that my client gave a bunch of members. There was no formal investigation going on, and a letter was drafted by one congressman for information. A bunch of BP people responded to it, including my client. No subpoena, no record, no testimony, no prior notice about what the issues would be. It's not irrational if you're going to use a big federal felony to require formality, to require a committee involvement. And the last thing I'd say, by far the most relevant authority in this case is the Ramos case. That's the case that was a border agents got in trouble for suppressing evidence. Bottom line, the government said there was an internal investigation by the Border Patrol, and the government said official proceeding, which is the language of 1512, includes informal investigations. This court, Judge Jolly again writing an opinion, said no. You look at the context of 1512, we're talking about judicial and judicial-like proceedings. These agents screwed up, but obstruction statutes don't cover all of those things. You have to look at the context of the statute. There were a couple of cases where internal investigations, I think one from DEA, one from an OIG, were used as prosecutions. You all looked at those cases and say, no guidance there, doesn't apply. And then you said, and I think this is the most important language, we're very confident that if you look at the context of the statute, official proceedings limited to judicial-like proceedings. But it's a reasonably close call because proceedings, if you look at the dictionary, could be broad, but we have the rule of lenity. We don't think we need it.
Okay, Mr. Weingarten, bring it down to a close now. I'm not going to cut you off right there, but you've got about two sentences. Go
ahead. Okay. Ramos rules here as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, Mr. Smith.
Your Honors, just to work backwards forwards here, I'll start with Ramos. The issue in Ramos was interpreting what a proceeding is as far as an agency action, which is a separate part of the statute from committee. And this court knows that that phrase is actually a defined term in the statute. And the court emphasized in Ramos the meaning of that term was dependent on, it said, basically before an agency, and it held that before entailed some degree of formality there. That is the reverse in this context. The Fourth Circuit held in Mitchell, this has no such language like that, that an informal committee investigation or inquiry of any committee of the House is covered under the statute. That was the express holding of the Fourth Circuit that was spot on in this context.
What's the best elaborate, if you're quoting Mitchell or relying on Mitchell, what expounding is there of the due and proper exercise of the power of inquiry?
Well, I think the way that the Mitchell court defined an investigation or an inquiry is a legitimate exercise of investigative authority by an entity covered under the statute.
Wouldn't that exclude GAO, Congressional Research Service, and therefore that might clear out the brush of entities that we aren't thinking of as inquisitorial?
Your Honor, I think that could certainly be a good argument there. I'm not as familiar with the lines of authority setting up the GAO and whatnot to say that conclusively, but I think that Your Honor has a very good point on that. And
you're not prepared to say that's the government's position. Is that what you're saying?
The government's position, I think that what the court said in Mitchell is that there is a difference between 192 and 1505, and that 1505 encompasses informal investigations that are a legitimate exercise of that authority within an area of that entity's purview, an entity that's covered under the statute, which here, the subcommittee, that's clearly within the heartland of the statute. And we've talked a lot about strict construction, and I just want to make clear that we're not
in... The indictment does not say a whole lot about subcommittees. I mean, it refers... uses the term congressional inquiry.
Well, Your Honor, the indictment, I believe on the record on appeal on page 27, begins a section entitled the Congressional Inquiry and Investigation, which expressly alleges that the subcommittee in this case began.
It does say that. I'm not arguing about that, but then most of it refers to congressional inquiries and doesn't have anything to do with subcommittees.
Well, Your Honor, I believe the way it's structured makes clear that it's talking about the inquiry that we just alleged was taking place. And indeed, I point out on page 5 of Mr. Rainey's brief, he states in his facts section that we have alleged that the letter and that the briefing was part of this subcommittee investigation. So I believe that aspect is clear from the indictment. And, Your Honor, I would back up to a couple of points that Judge Garza made. Number one, the presumption, according to the Supreme Court, is that the plain and ordinary meaning applies here. They have not overcome that presumption because the phrase is not a committee or a capital committee. It is any committee of either house. Now, the language about a joint committee is in the...
Does that include caucuses?
Your Honor, I don't think a caucus is vested with any sort of official House authority. I think that would be a sort of party group that's an ad hoc group formed in the House, and that would be a separate and apart from...
I mean, it is a committee. I mean, if you just place the plain, ordinary dictionary definition, I mean, it's a group of people that are determined to...
I don't believe that they have any official delegated authority stemming from the House's constitutional function, Your Honor, which I think that that's more along the lines of a party group, and I think that that would be not in the heartland of the statute as we believe that this is here.
The heartland of
well,
the statute.
Your Honor, it's very likely that would not be covered.
And you're talking about the heartland of the statute. I mean, that's...
Your Honor, I'm not sure the exact status of how these groups are set up. If it's simply
a
partisan group...
I'm not pressing that.
That is not vested with House authority, I think that would be excluded. Your Honor,
you're not bringing any kind of limitation on the term committed that I can see. But
Your Honor, we bring the limitation that's inherent in the definition of the word, and I think Judge Higginson has made...
Well, caucus would be inherent in the definition of the word.
Your Honor, but it has to be of either House, which would encompass an official body set up to do the official business of the House, as which a caucus or a party caucus would not be.
They're official congressmen.
They are congressmen, but
particular legislation.
But it has to be the body, any committee that is not the congressman itself vested with the authority, but the committee itself.
And then you say any committee means whatever the common meaning of the dictionary is, and the caucus means a committee. I mean, within that's why it has some technical meaning.
Sure, Your Honor. I think that would fall within the definition potentially of any committee, but again, of any House is the limitation that Congress put on this, that it has to be any committee of either of any House, which to me at least...
So a committee does have technical meaning.
No, Your Honor. I think that they put a limitation on the plain and ordinary meaning of that word. It has to be any committee that is one formed in the House to conduct its official business.
It doesn't say one formed in either House.
Well, it's any committee of either House, Your Honor. We thank the court for its time and ask you to reverse the district court.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Smith.